Welcome to the Unpolished MBA. I'm your host, Monique Mills. Many times entrepreneurs are called unpolished because they are scrappy and do things in unconventional ways. Well, I like the name Unpolished MBA so much that I even trademarked it. So on this podcast, we commend those with practical experience because they've proven time and time again that one can be successful in business even if they don't have a formal MBA degree. So on each episode, we discuss topics related to business and entrepreneurship, and I've been told that my guests and I provide insights and inspiration to aspiring and current entrepreneurs alike. So this is the place where you can come and hear real life stories that can help you navigate both challenges and opportunities in business. Now let's jump into the next episode.
I did a keynote in August, and it was called Beyond Networking, Unleashing the Hidden Power of Connection to, I think it was like, push, you know, propel your career forward or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I talk to scientists all the time. Those are my people, even though ironically, I am not a scientist by any stretch. And they have trouble generally going beyond the data. And that, particularly when they leave academia, as most do, and don't become PhDs, only about 8% stay in academia after getting their PhD, but they're all trained like they're going to be tenured professors. So they don't typically have the communication skills and then the mindset to be really successful beyond the ivory tower. And that's where I come in. So that's like my whole business is teaching scientists how to demonstrate their impact, their value to their most important stakeholders. So it could be during a job interview to a potential investor, which is kind of where it ties in with the MBA. And part of that is storytelling. And what I say is storytelling, the overall mindset for storytelling is the story is not about you. It is about the story listener.
I've had great people like you show me that being smart is not enough to be successful. You have to know how to communicate. And so with that, Mark, I want to welcome you to the Unpolished MBA podcast. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Monique. Thanks so much for having me.
I love it. So this is Mark Baer, you guys, of Baer Strategic Consulting. So tell me a little bit about that, because it really ties into how we met on LinkedIn. So tell me a little bit about Baer.
Sure, absolutely. And I always say, like, no affiliation with that large company you've heard of. It's actually my last name. And it was so funny, Monique, and wonderful the way we connected through Melanie Flores, who I had on my podcast, which is called When Science Speaks. And she's an engineer, as you are, as I am not. And we started talking about this power of connection, which is something that I love. I think I'm sort of hardwired for it. And I love to talk about it and teach about it. And so we started this thread, or in response to, I don't even know if it was Melanie's post that we were responding to, or somebody else's post and Melanie. So, you know, just talking about and unpacking this idea of connection, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point, like what it means really to do it. And I mentioned this book that I am reading. It's David Brooks's new book, New York Times columnist. And he's written this book, which is like How to Know a Person. And I love it because really understanding the whole person, not just their credentials and, you know, their work, you know, we sometimes, our brains are wired to try to be efficient. So we have all these shortcuts. So like, where'd you go to school? Okay, I'm already thinking what type of person you are. Okay, what do you do for a job? and those are pieces of the puzzle, but they don't really enable a real deeper understanding of the person. You know, I say you're more than your credentials. And
that's
you're really
true.
All right, let's take a moment to thank the biggest sponsor of the Unpolished MBA. That's TPM Focus. TPM Focus is a strategy consulting firm that helps startups and small business owners generate revenue and find their way to profitability when they're launching a new product, or in a new market. So reach out to tpmfocus.com. TPM stands for The Profit Matters Focus.com.
And you're the sum of, you know, your experiences. And so many of us have had similar experiences, and uncovering those in discussion and being authentically curious about others' experiences. And then, of course, you see similarities. And that is one of the elements I talk about really with connection, like what is connection? It's sort of uncovering these similarities, which can seem superficial, you know, going to the same school or being from the same hometown, or both loving pickleball. I don't know the demographic of your audience. I just get it. I've never done pickleball, but it's like a big deal. Or, you know, both being big fans, you know, of the Falcons. Whatever it is, like it's a way to understand a person maybe even more deeply. It's funny because these can be superficial connections, but they kind of give us a positive feeling and help us to relate better and have productive relationships.
Spot on. So, okay, you bring up a good point. I get nervous when asking people too many questions because I don't want them to feel like I'm interrogating them, you know, and that's a big thing. But back to what you're saying, really what I'm trying to do is learn about them and find some things that are in common. Let's say it's a place they've traveled to. I don't know. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, I visited there once. What did you think about this? And so that kind of gets common ground and conversation going. So it's important, but I think the main thing is to get into the psychographics of people. I just posted about this today on LinkedIn. Like, how do they feel about things, not just that?
Yes, you made a really good point about, well, like operationally, how do you do it? You don't want to feel like you're interrogating. And just the example that you gave, like, what was that like? You know, I think that was what I was sort of going to say. Like, they say something, oh, you know, we've both been to Aruba. Oh, where'd you stay? Oh, what was that like? Like, what'd you think? Like an open-ended question right after something that they've said doesn't really feel like you're just rapid fire asking question after that seems sort of unrelated. So I think that's a great way to do it. You know, during the Q&A of one of these keynotes I did, someone said, well, what happens if like you're being authentically curious, but then after like the other person really isn't giving you anything, like one word answers. Like, and I said, you know, you can just politely, you know, move on. If they don't want to interact that way, that's totally fine. Maybe it's just a bad time and they're thinking about something else. They've got some other thing that they are preoccupied with. Totally fine. The person who asked the question was almost feeling like, well, is it my fault? I said, no, it's not your fault at all.
I want to back up there because sometimes it is their fault. And I just want to say it's not that person. So there's a few things that I found. I'm an engineer, so I had to learn these things, okay? That's not how we're trained. We look at facts and figures and everything is black and white. And as you grow and in your careers and all that, you understand, like I said, I've met great people like you that helped me understand being successful was more than being smart. I say all that to say, I have found that it is people's fault, but they don't realize it. Two things. Body, nonverbal communication, right? Body language is huge. I've learned to smile more because it takes the barrier down that people may have, because a lot of times when you're in resting face, I don't want to use resting face,
yes, what
everyone says, you don't realize how you look. You could look unapproachable. You could look mean. You could look, you know, and it's all in the other person's perception. So when I'm speaking with someone new, I want them, my focus is on them. I want them to be comfortable.
Yeah.
And even though I may not feel like smiling, it's not like, oh, I'm in this happy mood. Change the tone of your voice, change the way your face looks so that you're making the other person comfortable enough to engage with you. And I think a lot of folks don't even think about it. They're just being themselves. So I'm not placing blame. I'm just saying it's not conscious that you have to put the guard down on the other person. So they're like, oh, okay, yeah, this person is nice. Raise your voice higher versus lower. Right? You know what I mean? Stuff like that.
That's so true. And that's absolutely a huge part of it, because we see someone in the first nanoseconds, we're like thinking before they say anything.
Yeah.
If you're talking to someone and they're not making eye contact with you and they're kind of looking around the room, well, like you said, like these nonverbal cues, like, okay, they must not really be interested in this. And it makes me feel bad, you know, like they're like, I'm not as important to them as, you know, what's happening somewhere else. So yeah, being conscious of that absolutely is so important. And you can tell, you know, it's funny, Bill Clinton, regardless of your political leanings, you know, Bill Clinton was sort of, as a politician, was recognized as just being a master. And President Obama has this too. It's like when they're talking to you, you feel like you're the most important person in the world, right? They generally, and both of those people were curious, academically off the charts, and also able to explain things in ways that, you know, that clicked and meet people where they are as far as the explanations and distill things down. So that nonverbal part, though, as you mentioned, when particularly when you're in a one-on-one or even in a group, you know, I came from Capitol Hill, where I worked for about 20 years, and it was always interesting to see when, say, a scientist or someone would come into the office and there were, say, three people in the meeting. There was the boss, and then I was in the meeting and maybe one or two other people. I was always curious to see where the guest in the meeting, the person presenting, looked. Like, where were they looking around the room? And were they only looking at the boss because they just assumed that's where the power was? Or were they more, you know, consciously making an effort to include other people in their gaze? And that second part, I think, is so important, doing that as well, not just looking at who you think is the most important person. This also often would happen with scientists coming in, and there would be, our female staffers would be in the room, and they would not look at them. And they would spend all their time looking at the boss. And I always sort of was thinking to myself, you know, those staffers, those are the PhDs in our office who are going to be working on your issue, you know, and they're the ones who are going to be leading, and you're not even paying attention to them. That's a big, big mistake.
Oh, yeah. I definitely have experienced that in my career, and folks who have done it, when they found out that I was the person that was in charge, they're just like, oh, okay, now they feel embarrassed. But I don't want them to be. So I break the ice by doing the things I just mentioned, right? So it's all in tone, body language, what have you, because I understand how folks are programmed in our society to believe that the men in the room are the power figures, and especially in my world of engineering, it's predominantly white men. So
right.
They see a white man and they see a black woman. Of course, he's in charge. And so, you know, it doesn't matter the age or anything. So it's just those biases, you know?
Absolutely. That's a whole series, right, of conversations.
Yeah.
Because I'm the white guy, right? But I'm very attuned to power dynamics because of the political thing and how people regard others without saying much or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when I walk down, even when I'm traveling, people ask me for directions, right? Because they assume that I know and I'm a tourist. I was just in Ireland.
You're smart, right?
And I say to my son, who's a little taller than me and he's got the broad shoulders, you know, you have a lot of responsibility as someone like that to include others, because people will assume that you are a leader, and you need to make sure that you bring the whole team around you with you right from the start. My old boss on the Hill was very good at that. He would always give credit to staff when they were the ones doing the work, and that made a big difference in that whole culture in the office. But yes, you've experienced firsthand, engineer, black woman, so people are going to have this default. And it's funny because most of the people I interact with are women scientists and engineers. And on the podcast, my podcast, I would say maybe 70% of the guests are female. And it's because you're just doing great stuff.
Oh, you know, it's kind that you're paying attention to that, because I'm telling you, most other folks completely ignore us. I'll just be honest with you, that we are ignored, especially the older you get too.
And I say to people, look, it's not, this isn't a, this isn't because I'm so magnanimous about it. This is because these people are doing amazing things. And that's the whole purpose of the show, is to provide their stories to listeners. And I could just go, you know, all these women of color who've been on the show over the years and, you know, continue to be. And it's because they're super duper stars, you know, and full stop. So,
yeah. Well, that's cool. I want to talk about what you actually do with Bayer Strategic Consulting, because this communication part, you working with female engineers and scientists, and then we're talking about the communication part. So all of this comes together in your work. Describe what you do and also how you got into it, being that you're not from the STEM fields.
Yes. Great. I'll do what I do right now real quick. So essentially, I do two things. I help really technical people, PhDs, engineers, talk to non-technical people in ways that are engaging and clear and memorable. And I have them, and those conversations can be, for example, as part of a grant application or an interview for a job or talking to investors or talking to policymakers. So it's people in your professional universe who don't have the technical expertise you have, yet they have the power to determine or at least influence whether your ideas, your career even sometimes, you know, goes forward or not. And then the second piece is really the same kind of thing, except just for policymakers. So if you are trying to get federal funding for your idea, you're a CEO of a company, you are, you know, an engineer, an inventor, and you're applying for a federal, you know, federal grant. You want to build a relationship with a state representative, a U.S. senator, whatever it is. Like, how do you have that conversation? And then afterwards, how do you build and broaden the relationship with that policymaker? So those are the two things that I do. And I do them through workshops, live and also online. I have an online class called How to Effectively Communicate Your Science. I should call it How to Communicate Your Science and Engineering. It works that way too. And then I do keynote talks, which are sometimes on connecting, like we started talking about. And then other times they're on things like, you know, more specific, like data scientists, like how do you incorporate data into your storytelling or into your presentation without just, you know, slide after slide of facts and facts. Like you said earlier, that's only part of the story. That's one element of what is typically seen as like three elements that you really need to have.
Mm-hmm.
How I got into this, it seems like in retrospect, like a pretty like linear thing, but it was not at all. I was a chief of staff in the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. House. And then after 20 years of working on Capitol Hill in the U.S. Congress, I decided I was ready for a change. But I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And it was around 2016, 2017, when Donald Trump got elected president in the United States. Big surprise, including, I think, to him.
Yeah.
And so scientists, I didn't really realize until I spoke at a conference. The conference was the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. It's this largest international scientific society in the world. And they have at their conference, they had an opportunity for people to come and talk. You had to submit an application and then a description of what you wanted to say. So I submitted a description to talk about how do you combat misinformation. And that was happening a lot in 2018 from mm-hmm. the White House podium and everywhere else. And so that ended up being a really popular talk, and it was covered actually in Science Magazine. So there's an article, I think in February 2018, about some of the things that I talked about, and it was really an interactive discussion. So the room became packed with people who were hungry for ways to debunk and defuse all this, I'll say, garbage that was coming out, things that weren't true on science-related topics and others. And as I walked around the conference, I found that it kind of hit me that if facts aren't really that important, than scientists and engineers, because AAAS is for scientists and engineers, although I think the scientists are overrepresented in that group. But nonetheless, if facts aren't important, then scientists and engineers really don't have anything else in their arsenal, right? You know, your work is, this has to be exact. This data has to match up or the bridge collapses.
Yeah.
Or the rocket,
that's,
you know.
That's right.
And so there's no room, like you said earlier, for this. What I learned was, though, that these groups, scientists and engineers, were starting to realize that if they didn't do a better job communicating, whether that was debunking or promoting what they did accurately to non-scientist decision makers, non-engineer decision makers, that they were going to be in serious trouble. So that's when the light bulb in my head kind of went off, saying, look, I have these skills on the communication, language, persuasion, negotiation side, zero STEM aptitude, last science class, AP bio at Framingham North High School, Framingham, Massachusetts, which I loved, by the way, I did love AP mm-hmm. bio. It was like the gears were grinding, though, like to try to do well, I had to really spend a lot more time than people who have, you know, other abilities, you know, who tend to those STEM fields, take to those more quickly. And so that led to literally on the conference floor, someone from UNC Chapel Hill said, we're having a symposium in June. You want to be the keynote speaker? I did that. And it led to what I do, you know, now, the workshops, the keynotes, the online class, focus mainly on scientists. But I do, actually, on my podcast, I just had this amazing engineer, and you know, we can talk about that maybe offline, who talks a lot about communications and stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. And I have had other engineers on the show. So that's how I got to do what I do. And I love it because people, engineers are building new things that help people. Scientists are discovering, building new things mm-hmm. that help people. And that's where the connection to politics, as I thought about it, because I would always get this question, why are you working with PhDs as a political person? And it's really the same kind of mindset. You want to create something to help people. And that's what I was doing all the time on Capitol Hill, but I was using different tools. But otherwise, it was the same goal.
Wow. You have had outstanding, fascinating career. I'll put a link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes, along with a link to your podcast is what we're going to talk about that. But you've had a fascinating career, and the way you've been able to transition into your consulting is phenomenal. But I'd be remiss if I don't go back to the misinformation, right? You were active in this business during the time of COVID, and yes. there was a lot of misinformation. Yeah. We had so many people die and things like that. How in the world, like, what was business like for you during that time? And were you involved in trying to help with that?
March 2020 was really, you know, the kickoff, if you will, in the US. My son had surgery in March of 2020. So we were so fortunate that like the next week, the hospital shut down. The government at that time is not looking for any solutions to this. You know, they're the source of it. I should say the government, of course, you had people like Anthony Fauci who were trying to help.
Sure.
But as I was watching this, I had spent 2 years, you know, I really started geeking out on how to combat misinformation like in 2016, 17. So by 2018, I did the talk, I felt like I had some really strong, good tools. I think that part of the issue, particularly with technical people, again, is this, one of the big problems with combating misinformation is we tend to think, particularly scientists, engineers, and others too, it's just, we think, oh, if I can just give them the facts.
The facts.
The facts.
Yeah, that's the problem.
You know, it's the facts. Because I just said, but the problem is that the people who are saying these things are not driven by logic, even though they might think they are. Oh, I saw something online or this study. It's emotion that is driving the misinformation. It's fear. It can be, you know, it also, for example, with the masks, you know, it's anger, it disdain. And so when I come in with all these facts to set the record straight, which are legitimate, true, scientifically based, evidence-based information, and I try to convince you using that, we're talking in totally different frequencies. You're really listening for the emotion, which is driving it. And I'm only giving you the logic. So it creates all this static. And people actually dig in more deeply on the misinformation when they're confronted with this. So what the first thing to understand is that you have to, and this really gets into connection, Monique, is, as you know, which is like, I have to ask with, I have to suspend my, you know, I might be angry or all worked up that this person won't wear a mask, but I have to really kind of switch into scientist or engineering mode and just like try to diagnose the problem a little bit. Like, you know, why do you feel that way? And legitimately be curious about it. And you start to peel this away and you'd be surprised. Of course, as you're peeling this away, you're oftentimes someone will say something and say, well, I have a newborn at home and I'm really afraid about these vaccines. Say, oh, really? I have a, you know, a one-year-old. Like, what's your, you know, boy? Like, do you have a boy or a girl? Like, as so I've done this kind of live. I did a talk at UChicago. It was like 2019. It was November of 2019. That's right. And after the talk, someone raised their hand and said, you know, you gave example. Look, one way to connect with people too is through their faith. And so I gave a couple examples as I was explaining ways to respond to and hopefully diffuse some the spreading of misinformation. And then afterwards, a scientist in the room raised her hand and said, you know, most scientists are atheists. And so your two examples revolved around faith. And so that's not going to work with scientists. So what should scientists do? And so I could have rebutted her assertion that it's all about faith or that scientists are atheists. Well, scientists are atheists. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's actually true. But regardless, I wasn't going to argue with that. So I went over and started talking with her. And I noticed like there was a little girl sitting next to her. Like this is a packed room of like grad students and, you know, some faculty and stuff. And there's like an 11-year-old. So I said, oh, is this your daughter? And she said, yeah. And so, well, I have, you know, I had an 11-year-old. I have a daughter as well. And so I asked the girl, you know, what do you like to do when you're not in school? You know, what do you like to do? And so I was basically showing, and I was, oh, that's interesting because my daughter does XYZ. She just is playing the ukulele. And so I said to her, you know, to the mom now, like, there are so many ways to connect with people that don't involve faith. It's just one thing to think about. There is a well-known scientist, climatologist named Catherine Hayhoe. She's at Texas Tech University. And she is she's an evangelical Christian. Her husband is an evangelical pastor, very well known in those communities. And she does talk about climate change by saying things like, you know, the Bible tells us that we should be good stewards of the earth. And in Texas, they talk a lot about, you know, it's a lot about oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? And so she uses faith, but it's really about values and emotion. Yeah. That's a big part of how you talk about, try to get to this idea of responding to misinformation.
Give us a few points on how to combat spreading misinformation.
The first thing to ask yourself before you engage at all is, what is the outcome I want from this interaction? Do I want to try to persuade the person that vaccines, that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine does not actually cause autism? Or do I just want to have them maybe think twice before they hit that forward or repost about misinformation, for example? And is that even feasible? So I think the first, you know, question is, what is the outcome you want from the interaction? Mm-hmm. If you're talking to a family member, like, is it worth like getting them all agitated? Like, are you going to be able, like, or, you know, so it's sort of a no, I kind of like a go, no go decision. So before the interaction, decide. And then, is that feasible? Is that outcome feasible? Say it is. The first thing to realize is that it is, this misinformation so often is fueled by emotion. So begin by asking some questions with authenticity, of course, and listen well to the answers. Don't think about the next thing you're going to say. And then, you know, you can share some of your thoughts about this. You can ask sort of further questions, but you don't want to start citing all this data immediately, right? That's really interesting. Where did you hear about that? You know, oh, well, I read something on the, you know, online about it. Oh, like maybe you don't remember where it is. I know there is a lot of information online. You know, maybe like I had both of my kids inoculated with against MMR and, you know, there were no harmful effects, but I understand people have different opinions. And then, you know, you're trying to also establish this connection in these, just listening, like you talked about body language, like just engaging with the person, like looking at them, eye contact, having all the things you mentioned, like that lowers the temperature immediately in that interaction. Nobody wants to be told what to do or told that they're wrong. But because people generally want to be consistent. So I thought that vaccine, this MMR vaccine caused autism. And now it's going to be hard for me kind of to let that go, because then I'm going to have to admit that I don't know what I'm talking about or didn't at the time. So one strategy is to kind of, we used to call it in politics, sort of a get well card. It's sort of like, you know, I can understand why you thought that based on the research you did and these other things, but now you can see that there's more, you've gotten more information, and, you know, there's other pieces of information that you're aware of now. So you kind of make it seem like, you know, that it's okay to change the position now, because now is a different environment than then, back then when they had those views. It was a strategy used with people who voted for Trump in 2016. Yep. And rather than saying like, how did you vote? Why did you vote for Trump in 2016? In 2020, it's like, you know, nobody, I'm sure there was a lot of anger and he was making all these promises. No one could have imagined that he would have done all these things. So now that you have this new information, you can kind of, you don't have to vote for him again just because you want to, you know, you voted for him in 2016, for example.
I mean, confirmation bias is a serious thing. Like, people will just continue to give you reasons why, even though deep down, I think they know whatever decision they made wasn't the right one. They're going to keep justifying it, and just digging their heels in. So when you talked about what do you want to get from the conversation, right? When you're trying to combat misinformation, some people I found, they're not even that rational. Like you said, it's driven by emotion. They literally just want to say something to get it off their chest, how they feel. And, you know, a lot of times that can exasperate the situation.
You know, one thing I do say is that there are these lost causes and you only have a finite amount of time and resources, energy, and you might decide it's not worth going into this interaction. And one key element to that decision, that calculation, is this piece of misinformation part of the person's identity? Like, I don't want any restrictions on guns. In our family, we have, you know, we've been card carrying members of the NRA for like three generations, and we go every weekend out hunting, and we get all the, of course, information from the NRA telling us the government wants to take your guns. And, you know, I'm on virtual, like all these Facebook groups with these other like-minded individuals, and in my community, in my neighborhood, you know, down at these clubs, that's who I am. So it's, the stakes are a lot higher for that person to let go of the idea that the government is going to come take all of our guns. And because it's part of their identity, it's not just a belief that they have, but it's actually like one of the pieces of who they view themselves as, their self-perception. Mm-hmm. Those are like the, I would put them kind of squarely in the lost causes side if you're thinking about persuasion. The other thing is, you know, you have to respond. If they're listening to emotion, then you have to be willing to be vulnerable and share some emotion about, you know, I can see as a new parent how hard that would be to decide whether to inoculate your newborn based on all this information that's flying around and on the internet and all these people saying sort of things. Like, empathy goes a long way. The person doesn't feel stupid for having that belief. Even with COVID, like, I can imagine, you know, let's just say you're trying to decide, there were within families, of course, there was a lot of talk. And in, you know, maybe you're old aging, but I have two, you know, my dad's 81 and my mom's 79. And it's like, if, you know, they ask me whether they should be vaccinated. And I'm thinking, oh, of course, they talk to their doctors, which my recommendation would be talk to your doctor. But sometimes people don't have easy access to a primary care doctor. So that doesn't work very well, or it's too difficult for them to connect with the doctor. And so, yeah, like, well, I'm thinking, you know, they're in a high-risk group, they should get vaccinated. But if they have side effects at their age, maybe that could really be damaging and fatal, God forbid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is such an emotional decision. So you roll in with, well, there have been all these clinical trials and they've demonstrated and the risks are really, you know, like, it's a different language. So I think you have to approach it from a willingness to be emotional and have that kind of connection and empathy as part of this connection umbrella, curiosity, empathy, and this body language that you described right off the bat. And then, you know, the person can maybe comfortable and say, well, you know, it's interesting because here's this piece of information, this little, you know, piece of data that so when the other thing is the messenger matters a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it matters so, so much. And there have been, you know, back 10 years ago when there were issues with autism and measles, mumps and rubella, I think it was the CDC or the Department of Health and Human Services was sending researchers out into these communities in Minneapolis or Minnesota generally, which were heavily populated with Somali Americans. And they were sending these like white guy scientists. And it's like, they realized afterwards, like that doesn't work very well. Like, how can you possibly understand me? It doesn't. So having trusted messengers who don't just show up for this particular message, like, you know them, they're your pastor, they're your whatever it is in your community, you know, you have a pre-existing relationship and that, you know, that relates to trust.
Yeah.
You've had that trust built.
That's something we're even seeing more conversations about in the realm of healthcare. And I just saw Scott Galloway do a post on how he agreed with another person, I'm not going to say his name, mm-hmm. on where DEI has gone and how divisive it is and it separates people and how different ethnic houses, and I say houses, but that's what we call them on the college campus, right? Mm-hmm.
I understand. Yeah.
Causes divisiveness. And I don't believe that to be true. People are just familiar with each other's ways and language and all that. It's not a place where they're sitting around plotting how to hate on other people or do something to other people. And just to believe that other folks, because they gather and they have similar backgrounds, are doing something nefarious, it's once again putting a target on folks who undeservingly, you know?
Yes. Yes. And I had said earlier, like what I kind of viewed as what does connection equal? Because I'm kind of, I had drilled into my head through my schooling, always define your terms. And
yes.
I view connection as social interaction, because we're social animals, plus mm-hmm. similarity.
Yeah.
And those similarities can be completely superficial, you know, seem superficial, like we talked about earlier. So mm-hmm. we're drawn into social situations. And I think it's kind of almost like an evolutionary trait that we're built to, because if you were ever exiled back thousands of years ago, you were alone in the wilderness, you didn't survive very long. And some people believe that's why some of us are afraid of public speaking, because mm-hmm. we're afraid of saying the wrong thing. Because from an evolutionary standpoint, if we ended up in a bad, you know, had done something in our tribe, literal tribe now, and we were cast out, then we were dead. You know, so this idea that, you know, that DEI is somehow being divisive, it's like the status quo is divisive,
right?
The way, you know, and so when it's example, a strategy, like, again, from politics, it's often used is, and you see Trump do this all the time, which he'll just accuse the other side of what he's being accused of, but he'll really emphasize it more even. So saying, you know, well, this is happening in our country, like, if you don't want to hear it, that's part of the emotion, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we say, well, we want to teach critical race theory. And I always feel like, well, you just want to tell the truth about our history. And that's really what it is.
Right.
You know, we didn't learn this narrative. we learned a sanitized version of the narrative. So now we want to talk about actually the way the country was formed. And there are institutions, you know, universities, for example, that are doing various things to try to respond. You know, all these, of course, all the land that we're on was native tribal lands.
Right.
So how do you deal with that? And universities, I went to Cornell for undergrad, and it's a land grant university. And for those people who aren't familiar with land grant universities, they were set up after the Civil War as a way for sort of scholars to gather, and they were mostly agricultural kind of technologies. That was initially the idea, to develop more modern agricultural technologies in the university setting, with the express requirement that you go out into the community around the university and teach these techniques so that your farmers in the area, for example, can learn the more modern farming techniques. And so, you know, when you dig into this a little bit, well, you know, so the federal government was granting land to these universities and individuals inside of universities. Well, the land they were granting was didn't belong to them until it was grabbed by force.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you know, by saying, and again, you say, well, is it fear now? People say, well, I don't want to lose the status. You know, I've had, you know, as a white male, I've, you know, been able to do whatever, you know, what I was always viewed as, and I successful and all these things. I think really, so I think there is a lot of fear that goes into opposition to DEI. And I think part of it in communities can be driven by economic inequality, is that people have all of this anger and fear and built up for a long time based on just difficult economic circumstances. So someone comes along and says, here's who you can blame for that. Then people, you know, people jump on that.
Again, one of those things, taking it back to earlier when we were talking about, you know, understanding folks and how they feel about things, basically the psychographics of folks. And I did a post about it today, and I was explaining to folks in a relationship to business how you should understand the psychographics of the people you're trying to serve before you ever build a product, ever. Because you think you know certain things about them and what they would like, and you don't even know these people, but you think you do, especially if you're not in those circles, right?
I love that, how you apply it to business. It's so smart.
Thank you. I added in a little snippet that said, and guess who are the best folks at researching and exploiting psychographics of groups? And I said, wait for it. Politicians, right?
Yes.
Politicians have this down. How do you combat manipulation through the party understanding so much about your psychographics? Is there a way to prevent that manipulation?
Yeah, that's a great question. Give yourself time, and you'll notice one way to uncover a manipulator is when you say, you know, that's, you're making some really good points. I just need to think about, oh, no, no, this has to be done right. You know, okay, this is, he's trying to manipulate me into doing something. He's trying to get me to do something that's going to benefit him, and that I'm going to be sorry for it. So time is on your side. Number one is, don't be rushed into making a decision and ask for more time, and that can surface the manipulator when that person just all of a sudden ratchets up the urgency. And then asking for what I call sort of a trusted third-party validator. You know, and this works in a variety of ways too. Like even when you want to persuade people to get vaccinated, you know, getting people from the community. It was very interesting. Somebody told me about the study where a piece of conventional wisdom during COVID was minority communities aren't getting vaccinated enough. And as time went on, this woman, this scholar wrote about it, and she said, you know, actually, minority communities are getting vaccinated at a rate disproportionately higher than many other subgroups in the U.S., including white conservative Republicans, which were like at the bottom of the list as far as vaccination, you know, vaccination rates. Thinking about persuading and the difference between persuasion, all based on facts and evidence, and you're not trying to trick someone into doing something against their self-interest, versus manipulation, which we started talking about. But in persuasion, having trusted third-party validators, I'm not the one who says this, you know, 3 out of 4 doctors recommend, or, you know, or it's somebody that you know and respect feels this way. as well. And as I'm sort of the mosaic of my decision-making process, like that's a big piece in that puzzle. If, oh, that person thinks it's a good idea. Okay. That's really, that helps me. Yeah.
That point you just made there reminds me of the book Influenced by Robert Cialdini. And he talks about how, I mean, that's just a staple, I think, for anyone's library.
Yes, should. I have one right. I have my copy right over there. Yeah. That was a big influence on me in grad school because I took a class on persuasion. Yeah.
Same.
Yeah.
That book really helps people understand kind of what's happening. Reading that book helps you understand some of the cues, right? And it's the same formula over and over and over again. I even see it on like the internet, on Twitter, on social media, right? And it's like, it's the same formula, just a different person.
It's funny because also on my shelves is this Aristotle rhetoric book. And I sometimes pull that out when I'm wanting to, you know, get some ideas or whatever. And these techniques really date back a couple thousand years. And you think about, you know, he talks Aristotle broke it down into ethos, pathos, and logos. And then that was part of the cornerstone initially of my class in grad school as well. And it's like, you know, it's also the credibility of the speaker, how you feel about the credibility of the speaker towards the speaker, you know, and of course, data is a part of that, the logos, the logic, and then the emotional aspects of that. And so it's the data never speaks for itself. It never has, really. So I guess from an evolutionary standpoint, like 2000 years is like less than a blink of an eye. Our brains in so many ways are wired the same. And that's why those strategies in that click, you know, cues, you know, still work and can be exploited or can be used for good or for ill, I guess. Yeah.
For that. Yeah. When you said the data doesn't tell its own story, like it goes back to people's capability to storytell. So you actually have a resource that talks about how to connect with folks through storytelling. You want to tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So one thing I'll just mention, my tagline for this idea of incorporating data is numbers need a narrative. And there's a great quote that a PhD, who's also a producer, I think on PBS, came up with. His name is just escaping now, but I didn't make up this other thing, which was that data is a character in your story, but it's not the whole story, right? So saying, yes, we want to deal in the real world and truth to the extent that we can determine it. And that's why data is part of it. Storytelling in the infographic I put together, which is really five secrets of effective storytelling and five different techniques. It's just a downloadable PDF. And essentially, the first thing to realize is that storytelling is not about you, the storyteller. It's about the story listener. And Monique, as you were describing how you really have to understand your user, you might think you have the best solution to what the user is looking for, but whether you come from that community or you don't really know, is what you said. And that's exactly right. And so understanding who you're talking to and what they care about and the language that they use to describe things, even, you know, the terminology is so critical. And then, you know, you want to make it relatable. When I teach my course to scientists, most of the examples I use, I pull from the specialties of the various students in the course. So if I want to show a graphic, I will show something, whether it's molecules or whatever. I'm not a scientist, as we talked about before, but I will do a little research on that because I want to make it hyper-relevant. And then as I teach this principle, I say, as you can see on slide number 6, like I could have used anything, right? But why did I choose to show it to you, you know, in this, you know, with this neuron, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, because I wanted to make it more relevant. And we have a lot of neuroscientists. A lot of the research that we've been talking about that you guys are doing relates to the nervous system and neurons. So yes, doing that is a huge part of the storytelling. And it's what I call connect before you communicate. And the connection information that you surface as a result of these things we're talking about, these authentic questions without interrogating, because you've got the right body language, as you perfectly added, is you get elements of things that you should mention or at least use as a jumping off point. Some people say, oh, it's just small talk, particularly technical people. Why do I need to do that? So
STEM hate small talk. I'm just telling you, with a passion, they hate it. They feel like it's worthless. What's the point?
Yes. Yeah. So I've been working on this, and I haven't actually, in my mind, I have the title, which is the disproportionately big power of small talk, or something along those lines. But it's not, it for technical people, I can understand why they think about, oh, this is a waste of time. And maybe if it's, sometimes people self-select into certain careers. So you say, well, the scientist might feel like, well, I'm in my lab doing my thing, just don't bother me. And so they don't really like interacting with people generally outside of their circles, right? And so you say, well, you need to kind of do this. Well, they don't like doing those sorts of things. Maybe they're more introverted and they don't like being in a group like that. And so sometimes they shrink away from it. They denigrate it like, oh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter. But the denigration, I think, if you peel it away, sort of comes from they're kind of afraid to do it. I'm not good at that. I don't know what to say. And I get nervous and I don't like meeting new people. There are, of course, ways to mitigate that. Because having, like you have, all of the technical wealth of expertise and the communication and connection abilities. And I tell people in the course, for example, or in talks, is like, you guys are so bright. And once we give you this additional element, like, you'll be unstoppable, which is the communication part. And it's like, because ideally, like, you want to have an impact with your work. And to be able to do that, you have to explain it and know how to approach it and all those things.
Right. Oh, you really seem to understand the nature of folks in STEM, because you work with so many in science, and engineers are the same way. There's a lot that folks don't really understand. Like I said, most of my network are engineers. And what a lot of folks don't understand is that we understand each other. So where, like, in the tech startup world, I can't tell you how many times founders will say, oh, I need to find a developer, but they are like not my favorite people. They don't have the greatest personality. They're mean. They're not the best communicators. And I can understand what they're saying, because that's the way it comes off to people who are not like that, right? And so I've been a bridge between the technical folks and the founder, especially if he or she is non-technical, trying to help them understand each other, because STEM folks don't necessarily wear their emotion or how they feel about things. You won't see it. So then you feel like they feel no way about something, right? Or they may respond to you literally with just a fact. You ask a question, they respond back to you with an answer that's a fact. And some people feel that shortness is snippy. It's a little attitude in it. And those things aren't true. So a lot of times throughout my entire career, even when I was in corporate, I was that in between person that could explain the technical stuff to layman's terms, right? The layperson's terms, so that they could understand what we needed, or what was happening, or what we were doing, right? In a friendly way, where they're just like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll give you $60 million for that. No problem, right? And so it's the work that you do is so important. I just want to say that. So congratulations on all of your success. I want to let the audience know, because I know we're wrapping up here, I want to let the audience know that you're going to provide an infographic called The 5 Secrets to Connecting Through Captivating Storytelling. And so a link to that PDF for the free download is available to all of the Unpolished MBA listeners. So Mark, can you tell us a little bit about your podcast before we wrap up here?
Sure, be happy to. And again, Monique, thank you for having me on the Unpolished MBA. Love it. Love what you're doing, and a fan of your work. Sure. And so When Science Speaks is a weekly podcast where it focuses on communication, not a surprise, of technical topics, and also careers that are non-academic. So if you are a PhD, for example, or you're an engineer, you spend some time in academia, you're wondering how to transition to a job outside of academia. What are some of the skills that you need beyond just your technical skills? And then this show is for you. So really three pieces of the show. One is focusing on effective communication. The second is careers. And the third is really the X factor, which is, you know, like you've done here, Monique, where you have someone on the show and they mention things in resources, and then listeners contact them, access those resources, and get a real benefit. You were talking offline before about how that happens. And that's so meaningful to those of us like you and I who do these shows, which is that listeners get real benefit from listening that can improve their lives. They've got a new job or something like that. So that's the third piece of it. So communication, careers, and then, you know, providing a platform for listeners to connect with guests and hopefully get more value.
Fantastic. So where can folks best connect with you or find you online?
You can go to my LinkedIn profile, and that's one way, and send me an invite that you would like to connect. Mention the show would be great. And my website is bayerstrategic.com, B-A-Y-E-R, strategic, one word, .com. And you can connect with me there as well. The podcast is at whensciencespeaks.com, but it's also on all the other platforms, Spotify, Amazon, Apple, all that kind of stuff. So your favorite podcast platform should have When Science Speaks, also available at whensciencespeaks.com, where you can become a friend of the show, which basically means you will get pushed to your email inbox the new episodes. So you don't have to go anywhere else for them. They'll be right there for you to listen to.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, I want to thank you again for joining us today and sharing so much of what you do. I wish you the best as you continue down this path with your company. So thanks again.
Thanks, Monique. It was a pleasure and a privilege to be here with you.
Thank you for listening to the Unpolished MBA podcast. To hear more episodes or to request to become a guest, please visit unpolishedmba.com.